Norman Olney back with To the Point. Russia under Soviet communism was the favorite target of American politicians all through the Cold War. Ronald Reagan called it the evil empire, and despite its vast reduction in power and territorial control, Mitt Romney called Russia America's number one foe as recently as 2012. But Donald Trump is a different kind of Republican. He's making no secret of his admiration for President Vladimir Putin.
He is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing he called? I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country.
Now, on the campaign trail, the president treated Trump's praise of Putin as a political joke.
He loves this guy. Loves this guy. Think about what's happened to the Republican Party. Right? They used to be opposed to Russia and authoritarianism and fighting for freedom and fighting for democracy. And now their nominee is out there praising a guy, saying he's a strong leader because he invades smaller countries, jails his opponents, controls the press, and drives his economy into a long recession.
So, what do we know about Vladimir Putin and his views about Donald Trump? John Micklethwaite, editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News, interviewed Putin for 2 hours recently in Vladivostok. Here's a piece of that interview.
Who would you rather have at the other end of the telephone?
I would like to work with a person who can make responsible decisions and implement any agreements that we reach. Their last name doesn't matter.
John Micklethwaite, welcome back to To the Point.
Very nice to be back.
You could call that a dodge.
Yes. No. He then. I then asked him. I pushed him and said, "Look, you have Hillary Clinton, who Putin himself has said he thinks was trying to destabilize him back in 2012. She was pushing the protests." And in Russia, the idea that you might get overthrown doesn't mean necessarily that you retire to a nice presidential library and have a happy time. So it's difficult to imagine that he likes her particularly. On the one hand, you have her on one hand, and you have Donald Trump, who's written this long series of sort of elegiac, I even use the word homoerotic, praising Putin for his bravery, his muscles, all these sort of different things. And surely on the basis of that, you know, he wanted Trump. And again, he sort of dodged it a bit, but took the opportunity to sling a few blows at Hillary. And then that started a thing, because Hillary then replied. Personally, for what it's worth, my guess is actually Putin probably might, in the end, rather have a very weak Hillary rather than Trump, because I think Putin likes being the great unpredictable. And if you had Donald Trump in the White House, you would have somebody who would be more unpredictable than he is.
Let's listen to that question once again that you just paraphrased yourself and just hear how you put it to Vladimir Putin.
Are you really telling me that if you have a choice between a woman who you think may have been trying to get rid of you and a man who seems to have this sort of great affection for you, almost sort of bordering on the homoerotic, you're really going to go for, you're not going to make a decision between those two because one of them would seem to be a lot more favorable towards you?
Now, Putin didn't take you up on that one at all, but why did you use that term, homoerotic?
Well, no, it was largely an attempt to goad him, but it's it's actually a perfectly respectable word to use, I should add, not least because I'm a trustee of the British Museum, which probably has the greatest amount of homoerotic art in the world. But there is something rather kind of, there is a sort of manly praise element about Trump and Putin. It's very much he's a strong leader. He goes on about he pushes a lot of those particular verbs towards Putin. So I thought it was worthwhile throwing it towards him at least. But all Putin did was smile. And as I said, he kind of evaded the question a bit, but then sort of we came back to the issue about what happened to do with the hacking of the emails. And there he sort of went further and said, look, honestly, you shouldn't worry about what happens at the Democratic headquarters, about who the hacking is. The real issue is what was found out and what was going on. So I think Putin, I think, is enjoying the American election, is the honest truth. His starting point is that he wants to have
America back. He wants to have Russia back in the middle of the conversation. And that's what he's managed to achieve. I mean, if you look at the past 10 days or so, there's been a lot of Putin in the American election.
We should say the New York Times has referred to this as a bromance. There's nothing wrong with that term either. But these are terms that are not generally used in American politics, certainly not in presidential politics. This is new and different.
Yes, it is. And it is a bit weird. I think, you know, Obama's got a point, is that Trump, you wouldn't normally expect a Republican candidate to be quite so enthusiastic about a fairly authoritarian Russian figure against that Donald Trump, who I actually have just watched as an economic thing in New York, is an unpredictable figure. I think it's worth sort of looking at where both of them start. I think that Trump starts from the thing that, one, strong leadership is what he's all about. You look around the world, and again, I've had a long and questionable relationship with Mr. Putin, dating back to my days at the Economist, where we didn't always get on very well. But there's no doubt that, you know, Putin is a strong leader by most people's judgments. He takes very quick decisions and moves on it, and that, I think, is attractive to Trump. On the other end, I think that Trump provides a mechanism for Putin to get back into the sort of world affairs. I think Obama's treatment of Putin, whichever way you look at it, has not worked particularly well, because it's been a mixture between treating Putin with sort of general disrespect in terms of saying that correctly that he's made a lousy job of the economy, that he's, as Obama just pointed out in your clip, has invaded small countries, done all these different things. But Obama's tended to write down Russia as a country, whilst at the same time he's allowed spaces to come about in different areas of the world, such as the Middle East, which Putin has filled that vacuum, and that's most notable with Syria. So from the relationship between Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin, I think possibly has not been one which has been altogether healthy for the world, although I have a lot of sympathy with where Barack Obama started from.
Well, tell us more about Vladimir Putin. You said that you were there for The Economist. You had a relationship with him. You didn't get along very well, but now you've been able to get 2 hours consecutively with him. Not many people are able to say that, and he remains a pretty mysterious character and a somewhat ominous character, I think, to a lot of people in our audience. What can you tell us about him? What's he like?
I think, Putin, you have one element. He's a surprising figure. If you go back and read the sort of things we all wrote about him before he came to power, he seemed like just another kind of Yeltsin flunky, not particularly impressive. You know, he was from the more routine, perhaps more mundane part of the KGB. He'd risen up in St. Petersburg. But against that, I think he has shown an enormous sort of, I suppose, cunning in terms of being able to hang on to power in Russia, which is not an easy thing to do for as long as he has done. I think he has an agenda which is strangely similar to Trump's, to the extent that if Trump is trying to make America great again, Putin is trying to make Russia great again. And for him, the big sort of sin was the collapse of the Soviet Union. He keeps on saying he doesn't necessarily want to reunite all the countries that were in that, but he wants Russia to be seen as a big country, seen as something that is permanent and an influence throughout that region. And that is his underlying motive, but at the back of it, he's incredibly opportunistic. So when he sees a vacuum like he saw in Syria, he grabs it. When he sees a vacuum or a chance to do something like taking Crimea, he does that as well. So it's a mixture between a man who is somewhat Machiavellian. He's not. I don't think he's really a strategist. He has a list of kind of goals, but very, very quick in terms of opportunism and grabbing things.
Again, John Micklethwaite is editor-in-chief for Bloomberg News. I might point out that if they're both trying to say that they make their countries great again, Donald Trump is starting out with a much easier situation than Vladimir Putin. And I want to get more on that from Masha Gessen, who's a Russian and American journalist, author, activist, noted for her opposition to Vladimir Putin. And thank you very much for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
A moment ago, we heard President Obama ridiculing Vladimir Putin, effectively, and talking about authoritarianism and how he invades smaller countries, jails his opponents, controls the press, drives the economy into a long recession. What has he done for Russia, and how has he been? How do you perceive him as one of his opponents?
I think President Obama's description was pretty accurate. I would like to point out that he doesn't just invade smaller countries. I mean, he has annexed part of one of the largest countries in Europe, of Ukraine. It's a country of 50 million people. And Putin carried out the first forcible annexation of land in Europe since World War II. I think Vladimir Putin is a threat to the post-World War II world order. In fact, I think he has done his utmost to destabilize the West, and he has succeeded to a large degree. And his, you know, the Russian hacking of the DNC and other servers in the States is just one small part of that.
He obviously wouldn't accept responsibility for hacking the DNC, but did say the information that came out was important. Why do you think it was important to him?
I don't think it was important to him. I think he was using sort of a standard, non-denial when in that interview. I wouldn't, I don't think it's worth analyzing.
What about Trump himself on RT, the Russian state TV, courtesy of Larry King? How closely are people in Russia following the American election? Does it matter to them?
You know, when you ask a question like that, how closely are people in Russia following this or that, you're sort of framing it in terms of a democratic society where there's a public that has opinions and those opinions are informed. And everything about that assumption is wrong. The Russian media aren't following the American election very closely. I think America feels very far away. Also, the way that Russia has been viewing the United States for most of the last decade, but especially the last few years, has been as an enemy. And the Russian military doctrine, among other things, reflects that. It may have been just one failed Republican candidate in this country who called Russia America's main foe. But as far as Russia is concerned, the United States is officially its main strategic enemy.
So, John Micklethwaite, back to you, the editor-in-chief for Bloomberg News. You've known Putin for a long time, and you've got this interview with him. It sounds as if he's a different person when he appears on television or with your, I shouldn't say television in general, but as he appears in Russia as opposed to the way he presents himself to the West.
Well, two things I should say. I've only met Putin three times in my life. When at The Economist, we weren't friends, so the chances of seeing him were very few and far between. But I think in terms of, there is something in that. I think in terms of TV interviews with the West, he tends to be, a little bit evasive, but generally polite, much more so than certainly he is in private, and certainly much more so than I think he does sometimes appear on Russian television in a more bellicose way. And he does similarly control Russian media very effectively, or a large amount of it. I think the interesting question for America is the Obama blend, which I think Ash is absolutely right, is that some of the things Obama said are extremely correct. But that blend of being quite dismissive about him on the one hand, on the other hand, being actually quite reluctant to stand up to him in terms of putting troops into the Baltic states, those sort of things, which are sort of real political things, that maybe hasn't worked so well from the perspective that one thing that Putin craves beyond anything else is some form of respect.
So, Masha Gessen, what about that, this form of respect that he's looking for? How important do you think that is? And as a reporter on both Russia and the United States, how odd do you think it is that a Republican candidate for president would be so attracted to Mr. Putin?
Well, I think it's bizarre. I want to use this opportunity to just object to the term homoerotic. I think it's a really bizarre way to try to inject, to basically discredit a candidate who fully deserves to be discredited, but don't use, borderline homophobic language to do that, which is what that really is.
You're going to stay with us for a while, and John Micklethwaite is going to leave in just a moment. So let me ask him to respond to that. Were you trying to put Mr. Trump down or Mr.
No,
Putin down?
As I said, I don't regard it as a particularly kind of pernicious word. It was just it was poking at him a bit. It seemed reasonable to me.
So, Masha Gessen, go ahead and finish your point. We have enough time for that. Go ahead.
So I do think it's bizarre that that Trump has expressed such admiration for Putin. I also think it reflects exactly what he thinks. He wants to be that kind of leader. He sees Putin in control. He sees Putin with astronomical support numbers. What I think he doesn't quite realize, not as he, you know, does he really have the intellect to understand this, is that that kind of what he calls leadership is possible only in an authoritarian system. And actually, in fact, I think, you know, Russia is reassembling itself as a totalitarian society. And that's where you get to see those kinds of numbers. I also, if we have a moment, I just want to...
We don't. We need to go to a break, but we will when we come back. And John Micklethwaite, editor-in-chief for Bloomberg News, thank you very much for being on our program so far. We'll come back, as I said, with Masha Gessen and others as we continue. And on our talking point later, both professional and college sports leagues are punishing North Carolina for its so-called bathroom law. We'll talk about that. This is To the Point from PRI.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about Donald Trump's high praise and apparent admiration for Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. A moment ago, Masha Gessen, who is both a Russian and American journalist and an active opponent of Vladimir Putin, said that the kind of leader that Donald Trump apparently admires is only possible in an authoritarian state. Let me ask you to elaborate on that.
Well, Vladimir Putin controls the media. He has dismantled the Russian electoral system, and the Trump likes so much is that he has 82% support in his country according to poll numbers. But those kinds of numbers you never see in a democratic society. Those are not opinion poll numbers. Those are sort of call and response numbers. That's where that's a situation where the public conversation has basically devolved to a state of ritual. And it's not that people are even hiding their true opinions. It's that they are living in a country in which there is no public politics, where all power is monopolized by one man who heads the state. I think that's very much how Trump sees an ideal power structure.
Let me introduce Jonathan Weiler. He is professor of global studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's co-author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. Professor, good to have you on our show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What about the kind of appeal that Donald Trump is making, and how do you see it being picked up at this point by Republicans and others who support Donald Trump?
Well, there's no question that the base of Donald Trump's support are those who are authoritarian-minded, individuals who have a strong need for order, tend to see the world in black and white terms, tend to be wary, suspicious, or worse of historically marginalized groups. In other words, are ethnocentric, and that combination has become an important part of the Republican base generally, and Donald Trump, particularly because of who he is, appeals really resonates especially strongly with that group of people.
Richard Hofstadter famously described the American paranoid style. Is that what you think we're seeing?
I think we're certainly seeing some of that. I think we're seeing, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot of discussion about how Trump is appealing to so-called white working class voters. Those of whom are downscale, economically sort of struggling. But what we're really seeing when we look at the numbers more carefully is while he's appealing to white voters who don't have a college education, they're not necessarily folks who are doing badly economically. But what they do have in common is this kind of suspicious, wary, worldview, and in a world and a society that is changing, becoming more diverse and complex, they are reacting very strongly negatively to those developments, and Trump is really singing their tune in that regard.
Let me go back to Masha Gessen. Does that sound like the people in Russia that you were talking about a moment ago?
You know, only in the most broad terms. I mean, I think there are two very different situations. In Russia, Russia is a ruined totalitarian society, which has been sort of reassembling itself into a kind of order that very much resembles a totalitarian society, but that is the direct legacy of 70 years of totalitarianism. What is happening in this country, I think, has to do with, we're seeing a democratic society that is damaging itself, possibly destroying its own democracy. There's plenty of historical precedent for that, but just Russia is not a good example.
Back to Jonathan Weiler. Does it appear that the people who are supportive of Trump, when he speaks so fondly of Vladimir Putin, really know much about Russia and what it's been like under Putin?
I would say it's very unlikely that Trump supporters on the whole are well-versed in what's happened in Russia over the last 16 years since Vladimir Putin came to power. So I would doubt that. I do want to make a quick point about this, which is that 2 years ago in a survey, Republicans were asked, what do you think of Vladimir Putin? And his favorable, unfavorable rating among them was minus 70. There was almost universal contempt among Republicans for Putin. A couple of months ago, the same question was asked, and his favorability was still minus 25, which is to say two things. One, most Republicans still don't like Vladimir Putin. But two, to the extent that they have become more favorably disposed toward him, I don't think it has much to do with Putin's particular qualities. I think it has as much as anything to do with the fact that the Republican nominee is saying really nice things about Putin, and therefore, in sort of straightforward partisan terms, more Republicans are receptive to that.
Let's talk about another aspect of Trump's candidacy and of his reaching out, if that's the right term, to Vladimir Putin and to Russia. I should say that the two have never met, and reaching out may be the wrong kind of term, but he certainly has said a lot of nice things about him and often says, Putin says nice things about me, therefore I will say nice things about Putin. Kurt Eichenwald is a senior writer for Newsweek. His most recent article, a cover story, is titled The Trump Organization's Secretive Global Financial Web. Kurt Eichenwald, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
What is the secretive global financial web, and to what extent does it include Russia?
Well, Donald Trump's company is sort of a black hole. People have not been pushing into what it is. And it has a subsidiaries of about 500 different entities. And I started digging into what are they, and just looking at 15 that were overseas, I found business partners who were never closed, who are connected to various governments that play.
I'm going to interrupt because the situation with the sound is not good, and we're going to try to get a new connection with Kurt Eichenwald. I want to go back to Jonathan Weiler again when we start talking about Trump and his business dealings. Have they played much of a role in the campaign? Kurt Eichenwald just described them as a black hole. Do voters, Republicans, Democrats, or anybody else really know much about them?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is most people know very little about them. From a public opinion standpoint, the question is, who cares about them? And I think it's quite clear that most Republican voters, certainly most Donald Trump supporters, don't really care. You know, one of the things that Donald Trump has run on is that we live in this incredibly corrupt political system. And Trump, in fact, said at the Republican National Convention, nobody knows the system better than me, and therefore I'm the one who can change it. And so from that standpoint, at least among his supporters, I think in some ways he's insulated himself from charges of corruption, because his supporters believe, well, the whole system is corrupt anyway. Now, obviously, Democrats and those who are more wary of Trump to begin with see that very differently. And there have been lots of complaints that the media, for example, has not scrutinized nearly enough Trump's business dealings when they have talked endlessly, for example, about the Clinton Foundation.
Okay, let's get back to Kurt Eichenwald. We do have him now on a better line. You said earlier it's a black hole. There are 100 entities that you've been able to discover. Go ahead, tell us more.
Well, actually, it's my sound was bad. Obviously, it's 500 entities.
500, okay.
And I started digging into them. I just to find the business partners and the connections between them, I could deal with 15. So there are hundreds left. The business partners are those that are connected to governments. They are criminals. They are just regular financiers, but very powerful in their countries. And in each of those instances, there are national security implications relating to the partners that often are in conflict with the national interest, with the national security interests of the United States.
Can you give us some examples?
Probably the easiest one to say in one sentence is in Azerbaijan, where Trump's business partner, his father, is a member, a senior member of the Azerbaijani government, and has also been identified by American intelligence as someone who's laundering money for the Iranian military. So there you have a situation where you have Azerbaijan, a government official, Iran, military, and Donald Trump's partner. What is Donald Trump going to do in that situation? Is he going to clamp down on the father of his partner? Is he going to take some intelligence action? Or is he going to say, you know, my kids are getting a lot of money from that. I'm getting a lot of money from that. This is a guy who praised Brexit because a falling pound, which damages U.S. trade, was going to have more people coming to his golf course.
Back to Iran, of course, candidate Trump has said that he's opposed to the Iran nuclear deal. What about Russia? Are there specific partners in Russia? Might there be conflicts there?
Donald Trump has already gone off to Russia and trademarked his name. One of the things to understand about his business is what he does now is sell his name to other companies. That's why he ends up with so many corrupt folks. But he has tried to do projects in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, and in Sochi. He has he's the executive producer of the version of The Apprentice over there, which is ironically called The Candidate. And the person who heads that up, who's the host, is also somebody who was making money off of the privatization. He is one of in Russia. He is somebody who is deeply tied into the government. He is somebody who is directly connected to Putin and his advisors. You have a company by the name of the Moss City Group, which is headed by a fellow named Pavel Fuchs, who is also very connected to the government. And then you trace it up to Canada, where you have a partner, a man of integrity named Alex Schneider. But Alex Schneider does an enormous amount of business through Russia and through the Ukraine, and Donald Trump is a beneficiary of that. All of these people circle around this area. Donald Trump Jr. has said that they have many investors from Russia. We don't know who they are. I couldn't find them. It doesn't mean I'm not still looking. But the reality here is that because of the prominence of these individuals and because of their connections to the government, you have situations where Trump is going to have to choose between his financial interests, his family's financial interests, and the national security of the United States. And I have to underscore this. This situation has never existed in American history, and we don't know how far this goes. Again, 15 out of 500 is not enough. And those are the people who are partnered that I could find. I don't know if there are more partners in each deal. Each tracing them each down is not something that's easy to do. I had to be calling around the Middle East. I had to be calling around Asia, I don't think the American voters are going to have the inclination to do so. And so when everybody's saying Donald Trump, release your taxes, that's just stage one. He needs to release the names of all of his partners and investors. None of that will happen. I'm not that foolish to believe that he'll even release his taxes. But, the American people are buying a pig in a poke. They don't know who they're getting into bed with when they vote for Donald Trump.
Kurt Eichenwald making the point that we've never had a candidate for president about whom you could say the sorts of things that he just did. Masha Gessen, what do you make of this?
You know, I'm only qualified to talk about the Russia connection there, and there's nothing there to write home about. I mean, he had he licensed out his show to one of the richest men in Russia. That's it. Right. There's no other business dealings that have been documented, nor is there really any particularly sinister government connection. And I'd go further. That's not the point. The reason that Donald Trump is a threat to American democracy is not that he has business dealings with Russia, even if they were with the government, which they aren't, and even if he had major business dealings, which so far we don't know that he does. But he's a fascist leader of an ultra-nationalist, authoritarian, populist movement who has a real chance of getting elected president. That's a threat to American democracy. That's a threat to national security, not poorly documented connections to foreign businesses.
Kurt Eichenwald, back to you. Jonathan Weiler, back to you at the University of North Carolina. Do you see that there's an iceberg, that there's a lot of ice under the sea?
As far as support for Trump?
When we only know 15 of the 500 companies, do we need to know more? Is that important? Should they be demanding that Donald Trump reveal more about his connections?
Well, certainly I think it would be better for there to be more transparency. He's violated a longstanding norm in American politics when not releasing his taxes. But I tend to agree with Masha that there is a much more immediate and disturbing threat that he poses to American democracy.
Kurt Eichenwald, your take on that?
Well, I think what we're having here is two things. One is saying, let's change the subject. And the other is saying, I don't know about it, so it's wrong. And I'm sorry, I am the one who has been following these trails. I am the one who's been doing the interviews. And to just blithely say it's not true is really extremely offensive. And what I would say is folks are missing the point. They're talking about leading up to the election of Donald Trump. I am talking about when the man is in office, if he is president. You know, you go down the list of countries that I have examined. You have India, you have Pakistan, you have China, you have Vietnam, you have, Turkey is a horrific one. You have Azerbaijan, you have, time and time again, these kinds of circumstances. The world does not revolve solely around Russia. There are national security implications that deal with whether or not the United States is going to have access to a military base in Turkey. And as the article reports, the president of Turkey is saying to advisors that in a Trump administration, he's not going to allow the American military to have that access. Well, that is a primary staging area for the attacks on ISIS. So, to simply say the world is about Russia and, let's ignore all this other stuff. I mean, there's a sign that, you need to look at the bigger picture. It is about a global issue. It is about global conflicts of interest where property businesses, branding businesses, and connections that you may not be aware of, and if you don't know about them, it doesn't mean they don't exist, that are creating national security conflicts.
Okay. Hopefully we will be able to address in future programs the possibility that Donald Trump might be elected and what his presidency might be like. We're hearing a lot about that from Kurt Eichenwald, again, who's only investigated 15 of 500 different entities that Donald Trump controls in various parts of the world. I want to thank you all for being with us. Again, Kurt Eichenwald is with Newsweek. His article is entitled, "Is the Trump Organization's Secretive Global Financial Web?" Jonathan Weiler is professor of global studies, University of North Carolina, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's co-author of that. Marcia Masagessen is a Russian and American journalist, opponent of Vladimir Putin. And our earlier guest, of course, was John Micklethwaite, the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News, who interviewed Vladimir Putin. Thank you all very much for being on our program today.